pay a little rate for 2 years.
Yeah.
Fair one.
All right. Okay, so we're happy to have Ann Takapusa for our first seminar of the year, and the ratio of math to physics people is higher than I expected. Just
but it's one math to change. There are like 6 people in the stairwell.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she might.
Oh, this
take
we're
a slow for a sentence. Okay.
So we let them join us.
Okay, what is the ratio?
Well, right now the ratio is... Okay. The ratio was like 3-1, but it's about to go down.
Okay.
3-2, perhaps.
Okay. Good to know. I was actually worried about that, what the ratio is.
Well, you were asking me what the audience is going to
be. Yeah.
Okay, so your title, I've forgotten.
Well, me too, but...
Depth phase of the matter. How about that?
Okay. Let's see. So what I'm going to tell you about is based on 3 papers, which came up over the last summer and also a couple of weeks ago. So let me write them down. So the first paper is more about the physics of the problem, and the last two are more mathematical. So Sergey is my colleague at Caltech, and Ryan is a bright undergraduate when he started his project, but now a first-year graduate student at Berkeley. So what's the problem? Well, from a physical viewpoint, the problem is try to understand gapped phases of gauge theories. That was my primary motivation. And, typical thing which can happen with a gauge theory in any dimension to create a mass gap that is, what's a gap for the mathematicians here? Gap means you have a look at the spectrum of the Hamiltonian as a function of volume of your space. Then you might discover that, there's always some vacuum state which you can assign zero energy, but then the next eigenvalue can be separated from the vacuum by some amount which actually does not go to zero, is increased in the size of the system. So in that case, there's a mass gap. So this limiting value is called the mass gap. And traditionally, that it was, if your physical theory has this property, then if you look at energies below that mass gap, there's nothing but the vacuum. So it's a really boring theory. It's a unique state. Or effectively, the Hilbert space becomes one-dimensional. Like, if you don't have energy comparable to the mass gap, you cannot do anything with the system. However, it doesn't mean actually that the system is trivial, because if you look at your space, spatial slice, it's some compact, manifold. Well, it can have various topologies, and it's not just a torus or anything. So you can look at study, for example, then the ground state in general is not unique. So the space of states with zero energy, or essentially zero energy in large volume limit, is actually not one-dimensional. It's multi-dimensional. You can study what the dimension is a function of the topology of your spatial slice. You can study some complicated dependence in general. And if you want to understand this degeneracy, for example, for arbitrary topologies, it's best to think of this low-energy description of this complicated theory in terms of some much simpler theory called topological quantum field theory. So the idea is to understand, start with the gauge theory, basically some Young-Mills theory with some connection as your dynamical field, and then on the quantum level, and try to understand, if you look at really long distances or low energies, what sort of topological quantum field theory it produces to. Now, we can do it in various dimensions, and the higher the dimension, the harder the problem is. because a lot more things can happen in higher dimensions. Now, a related question is actually you can just start from the opposite end. First, try to classify all possible topological quantum field theories in a particular dimension. Sort of classify all possible, if you wish, gapped phases in a particular number of dimensions. That seems very hard, but one can try that too. Or at least one can try to construct new examples of these phases. And a second motivation, I'll get back to it in the end of the talk, it's maybe if I have the time, is something called symmetry-protected topological phases of matter. So that's some particular class of phases of matter, which is been a favorite of condensed matter theorists lately. And there are various approaches to classifying this. In particular, one proposal was that one can classify, or if you have in space-time dimension D, then all possible phases which have particular symmetry group called symmetry-protected phases, they classify it by in D space-time dimension by cohomology of the classifying space of this group G with coefficients in a reals modulo integers that you want. So explain why this may not be quite the complete picture and what potentially could be more complete description of possible phases, and that's related to this new kind of topological field theories I'm going to describe. Okay, so let me perhaps start with the brief review of the familiar topological field theories. So I'm going to be mostly talking about field theories in four dimensions, four space 10 dimensions, that is, three space, one time, or Euclidean four dimensional. But actually, most of what I'm going to say, I'm going to apply in all dimensions. So it's just easier for me to think about the physical dimension. So, suppose we start with a microscopic gauge group G. So it means it's a Lie group. So, and the fundamental theory has as its fields Young-Mills fields, that is, connections on a principal G bundle. Okay, so one can write some action functionals describing classical dynamics of these connections. But then once you turn on the Planck constant, some complicated dynamics happens, and then in the end, the one thing which could happen is something called the Higgs effect. And I'm assuming that the Higgs effect leads to this gapped phase of gauge theory, which means that your fundamental gauge group G, let me call it G node, doesn't survive. In infrared, at long distances, you only have some finite subgroup of this. So if that's... Maybe some other fields, yes. Yeah, in general, some other fields, right. That's one very simple situation when at long distances you just see some finite gauge group G and your gauge fields are connection on the principal G bundle, G node bundle. And G is finite. So all connections are necessarily flat, and if you have a compact manifold, the moduli space of flat of G connections is just a finite set. So that's clearly, this theory clearly has a mass gap, whatever, and it's topological because no particles in this theory. Okay. So now once you decided that your dynamics is like that, just that you're, in the end, your dynamics is described by just some by connection principle G bundle, you can just forget about this G naught and describe all possible reasonable topological field theory in full generality. And this has been done by Digraph-Witten. So I call this theories, it's called Digraph-Witten theories. And I'll say a purely Higgs. So the whole gauge group is just, people say, as a physicist say, broken down to finite subgroup, that's Higgs effect, and you end up with this topological field theory with a finite gauge group G naught, G. Okay. So These theories are very nice, and one can define them perfectly rigorously. That is, the path integral reduces to a finite sum of any compact manifold. And one can define it simply by replacing a manifold, well, basically pick any triangulation of a manifold in some self-decomposition and write down a filter using that triangulation. And you can show that the result is independent of the choice of triangulation. You can subdivide it, and the answers for any physical quantities do not change. In that sense, the theory is manifestly topological. So how do we define it? Well, we can just do some triangulation, something, and so our basic field should be connection on the G bundle. So for every one cell in this triangulation, I'm going to have some element G. Maybe I'll label all my vertices, and I'll have like G23 and G34, and all these guys I leave in my group G. And the partition sum is going to be a sum over all choices of this capital G valued variables. Some weight, some function, yeah, of all these g's. But these g's are not arbitrary. They should satisfy some sort of flatness constraint, which just expresses that this defines a g connection. And if it's g bundle, same thing in this case. And the constraints are that you have a triangle. Then G10, G21, G01 is 1. That's the constraint. So we impose one constraint for each two simplex. Okay. The higher simplexes don't matter. So just sum over all choices of this one simplex variables and subject this constraint on every one for each two simplex. Sorry, 02. Okay, and then the weight is some function which should be chosen so that the result is, for example, invariant under subdivisions of these triangulations, and has some other natural properties like gauge invariant. That is, you can also do gauge transformations. The gauge transformations, say G01, gets replaced by 10, by G, say H0, G10. Like this, where H0 and H1 evolves in this group. So the partition function on the closed manifold should be invariant also with respect to such gauge transformations. So the gauge transformations live on zero cells, and the variables live on one cell, and constraints live on two cells. Okay. Now, what are these functions? Well, it was explained in this paper of Diagram and Witten a long time ago, like 20 years ago, that this f, well, first of all, f is not arbitrary. F should also show some natural local expression. So f is really a product over all d simplices. And then f local, well, d simplices, let me call them, I don't say, p. And this fp of g depends only on the variables g on that particular top-dimensional simplex. That constraint is a locality. Your weight is a product over all sort of places in your space-time. So it's a local action, if you wish. Like each term, like this is not gauge invariant individually, but together they're all gauge invariant. Now, how many of these arguments are there? Well, fpg depends really on d plus 1, on d variables in d dimensions, you can see, let's say, in three dimensions. So what are the independent variables? Well, okay, if I choose element here and here and here on these three one cell, then all the rest are fixed by these flatness constraints. Like, it's enough to fix everything else. So on each three simplex, you have in three dimensions, you deal with three simplexes, so you need to fix three elements of G, and you're done. You know all G's everywhere. So therefore, in three dimensions, this F is a function of three group elements, and similarly in D dimensions, F is a function of G group elements. Now, it turns out that for gauge invariance and for subdivision, it's necessary and sufficient that this guy be a co-cycle, or first of all, a co-chain of G, well, with values in phases, numbers. It's a chain, and it should also be co-cycle, actually. So, so here, this is the usual complex. Well, this is the cochain in the usual cochain complex, which computes the cohomology of the group G, the coefficient in U1. So delta maps a function of D variables, the values in U1, to function of D plus 1 variables, the values in U1. And physically, it's very easy to understand where this constraint comes from. Because if you consider a four simplex, suppose in three dimensions, you want to consider consider three-dimensional field theory on a boundary of four simplex. Well, it's a very trivial space. It's there are no non-trivial G connections on a three-dimensional sphere. So you better get trivial answer for this weight. So if you take a look at the boundary of the four simplex, it's made of a bunch of three simplexes. Each of them contributes a factor like that. So you multiply them all out, and you're supposed to get one. That constraint is this constraint. That is for the boundary of four simplex, you're supposed to get a trivial partition function. That's the co-cycle constraint. And that simply expresses the fact that there are non-trivial connections on a manifold like S3. And then you can show that two co-chains, which are differ by a co-boundary, actually give equivalent physical theory. So really, actions are labeled possible choices of weights in this sort of discrete path integral labeled by elements of the cohomology group. So actions for topological gauge theory in D dimensions labeled by elements of the degree D cohomology group of G with coefficients in U1. Now, here by G I mean this finite group. I don't even see what the microscopic group was. I only see whatever remains after Higgsing, the microscopic gauge group, down to this finite group. Well, personally, I prefer to think about this cohomology. Well, it's not topological cohomology, it's group cohomology, but I actually prefer to think in terms of normal singular cohomology, and instead of saying it's cohomology with group, which is. And just think of it as a cohomology with topological space associated to the group called the classifying space. And if you wish, you can think of this data as defining a homotopy, well, a map of the homotopy from your cell complex to this space BG. So this space is essentially defined uniquely by the fact that it's has, well, by definition means that it's a connected space with pi 1 of BG being G and by I of BG being trivial for I greater than 1. Such a space called Eilenberg-MacLane space of this type, but 1 means that only pi 1 is non-trivial. And it's unique defined up to homotopy by this condition, and that's what the space is. Of course, solving this equation is not easy, but luckily there are other ways. For any particular group, one can compute with this cohomology group with finite amount of effort. Say for abelian groups, if G is abelian, which is physically by far the most common case anyways, one can give a general answer for this HD in any dimensions. So that's a sort of introductory part. So that's what happens when the microscopic gauge group is Higgs down to some finite group. However, we know that there's another phenomenon which can cut down on the number of degrees of freedom in the theory and lead to a gap phase, namely confinement. So now I don't want to get into the detailed physical motivation. I cannot prove what I'm going to say. I just had some bunch of motivating examples which explain in this first paper with Google, which is more physical. Let me just explain the slogan. Well, so while when the Higgs effect operates, you start with some group, microscopic gauge group, and then you end up with some subgroup. When confinement operates, you start with some microscopic gauge group, and you end up with a quotient of the group. So there's some. So we have some G naught, and then somehow, instead of mapping, your long distance gauge group is not a subgroup of it; it's a quotient. So it's a projection map from your microscopic group to your residual gauge group. So we cannot talk about unconfined subgroup. It's an unconfined quotient, if you wish. It's a confined subgroup, namely the kernel of this map. And then let me then another slogan which goes with this. So when you try to when you try to construct topological field theory associated with confinement, now so the opposite situation is this: you start with the microscopic gauge group, and then the whole thing is confined. Okay. So. So there's no low-energy gauge group at all. So it simply should be trivial, but it's not quite a trivial situation. And the slogan which goes, another slogan which is useful here, is that if you have only confinement, no Higgs effect, then the kind of topological field theory you're dealing with, instead of fields living on one cells, that is sort of gauge fields, one forms, you're going to have fields living on two cells, or triangles, or sort of two forms. Another slogan. So without further motivation, let me explain what this theory is. Confining topological field theory. So again, this Dagger-Witten theory applies in any dimension, and this we're going to tell you about also applies in any dimension. So here I start with G naught, and I'm assuming that the whole thing is confined, so there'll be nothing going this way. No quotient, or that quotient is going to be trivial. However, we have another group, which is called H, which maps to with homomorphism, with an onto homomorphism. So this is some, the genotype was some Lie group, and this is going to be some cover. But this doesn't have to be one to one map, it could be a kernel. So, for example, this could be, nice physical example would be SO3, say. This could be SO2, double cover. So in general, there's a kernel, I'll call the kernel phi2, for reasons which are going to be clear later. Now, of course, once I confine my group G0, there's nothing left over except some finite datum. And this finite datum actually is phi2. Okay. So phi2 is called, if you wish, magnetic gauge group. So physically, if you're a physicist here, phi2 labels conserved magnetic fluxes, or at-hoop fluxes in this theory. Now, so what sort of topological field theory goes with this data? Well, as I said, in the end, all you care about is this finite group, and actually it's abelian group, because you can check, it's a well-known fact that if you have a cover like that, so the kernel is abelian group. So on the lattice, we're going to try to define it in a similar way. So now we're going to have variables, say H, living on two simplices. And whenever I have a three simplex, I'm going to put a constraint on this H variable, basically this one. So which says basically the flux of this H through this tetrahedron is zero. And HI is denote, well, I have this tetrahedron. If I drop the ith, okay, 0 to 3, if I drop the ith vertex, I'm going to get a 2 simplex and denote HI, you know, the variable associated with that 2 simplex obtained by dropping the ith vertex of the 3 simplex. So that defines configuration space for my theory, and I can write a partition sum like this.
Additive notation because it's abelian.
Yeah, sometimes I tend to use additive notation when it's abelian and multiplicative when it's not abelian. Sorry about that.
That's fine.
Okay. So, and then the partition function, we're going to sum all these configurations. With these constraints, times some weight, the function of this H is. And again, H is, in D dimensions, a product of our all top dimensional simplices. So, now how many simplices are there? Well, before when I had the variables living in one simplices, for d-dimensional simplices had d-independent variables because the rest were determined by these constraints. So if I have d-dimensional simplex, then it turns out you're going to have d times d minus 1 over 2 variables h. And the weight should be some function of this number of variables taking values in U1, say, in phases, satisfying some constraint which ensures that the whole thing is gauge invariant. Well, there's some gauge invariance here. Forgot to mention that. Here, gauge transformations live on are elements of pi 2 which live on 1 cells. So in diagraph rhythm theory, variables lived on 1 cells, transformations lived on 0 cells, and constraint lives on 2 cells. Here, transformations live on 1 cells, variables on 2 cells and constraints on 3 cells. Now, might have guessed that probably there's something that lives on 0 cells as well. So there are gauge transformations between gauge transformations. So coming back to this. So we need some weight which depends on these many variables and which ensures that the partition function is invariant under subdivisions and also gauge invariant. So what's that? Now, just like to get an answer, it's convenient to reinterpret this data, satisfying this constraint, in topological terms. One can, just like in case of diagraph rhythm theory, one could think of this data as defining the homotopy class of maps to some space. Similarly, we can think about this data defining the map to some other space. So these H's define a map up to homotopy to space, which I call b squared pi 2, but maybe more traditionally is k pi 2. So it's Eilenberg-MacLane space defined by the condition, the following condition, that pi 1 is trivial. Sorry, so pi I is trivial if I is not 2, and pi 2 is equal to capital pi 2. So this was the reason I called it capital pi 2, because it's thought of as a second homotopy group of some cell complex. And that's actually the reason why pi 2 is abelian also. So, so that helps, because now we can construct this with the most general possible weight simply as cohomology of this space. So just like cohomology of a group was cohomology of some nice space, cohomology, this guy also has some cohomology. And degree D cohomology can, in principle, be computed. That's not particularly easy. Not as easy as for cohomology of BG, but it's possible. At least in low dimensions, which all I care about anyway, one can do that. So for example, in four dimensions, I'm interested in H4 of this in four space and dimension, H4 of this space. So let me just here the slogan. So the actions for confining TQFT are labeled by degree decohomology of this iterated classifying space. And say let me do the case of dimension 4. For D equals 4, this is a very nice computation. In one of the papers of Edinburgh and McLean from, I don't know, from 47 or 51, something like that. So this is space. This is simply a space of quadratic functions. On E1 with values, sorry, on pi 2 with values in U1. Now, what is this? Does it mean physically? Well, what is this in four dimensions, for example? Nice, well, simple case would be like, suppose my microscopic gauge group is SUM mod ZN. This H, which covers it, is SUN. So the kernel is Z mod N. So, okay, so what is this group, for example? Well, simple computation shows that quadratic functions on the group Z mod N would be called Q of Z mod N with values in U1. That's Z mod N if N is odd and Z to N, N is even. And the distinction is because, if you define quadratic function of a number modulo N, well, you can write a function like this. For N odd, you just write something like this. Times an integer, and then p. That takes values in, you know, in integers modulo in reals modulo integers, so it's sort of kind of as a phase. And this p clearly runs from it's an integer modulo n. But for n even, you can do slightly better. Well, here, p is integer modulo n. Here, p is integer modulo 2n. Okay. So that's why the answer, well, the slightly more quadratic functions in the case of n even than n odd. Okay, so what are the things parameterized? Well, physically, it turns out what these things parameterize is basically some special values, well, these parameters p. Well, the parameter is some special values of what's called a theta angle in the microscopic gauge theory.
Can I just clarify what you mean by quadratic function? What I thought you would have meant was that f of x plus y minus f of x minus f of y was a linear function.
It is, yeah.
Is that exactly what you mean?
That f of x plus y minus f of x minus f of y is bilinear.
So for example, on z equals z2,
yeah.
Is there a quadratic function which takes minus 1 on 3 values and 1 on the trivial value? I'm trying to relate this to the ARF invariant.
Quadratic, you have product of groups, right? Abelian groups. You have a product of abelian groups. And then this guy is Q of A plus Q of B plus, A dual tensor B dual.
Yeah, it's a matter of definition. I'm just wondering, does the arc invariant figure into your story or not?
Well, when I compute partition function on this closed form manifold,
yeah.
And then the arc invariant of this quadratic function will come in. That is, it will be the partition function is on a closed form manifold going to be basically after some numerical factor is going to, a real factor going to be some phase which is involves the signature of the manifold and the arc whatever invariant of this quadratic function. Well, at least, sorry. This guy, okay, in general, doesn't have to be non-degenerate. If it is non-degenerate, then indeed what I said is true. In general, it's a bit more complicated. And this bilinear form doesn't have to be non-degenerate. So what this shows is that if you look at basically gauge theory with gauge group like this, Sn mod Zn, then possible low energy behaviors, if the theory is just completely confined, possible low energy behaviors are labeled essentially by this P, which is either takes values integer mod n or integer mod 2n. So what does this mean? Well, it turns out that when you try to formulate this theory precisely on the lattice, this theory, people in the continuum, people usually write, say that the action of Young-Mills theory with gauge group G is something like this. I'll forget the number, 8 pi squared or something. Trace F with Jeff in four dimensions. And where G is a gauge coupling, theta is called a theta parameter, and F is the curvature of the connection. And A is a connection one form on some principal G bundle over your manifold M. Now, if you try to make it precise, the only precise way to make sense of this is to discretize your space-time. Choose some triangulation, for example, and then typically your connection is replaced by some group elements living on one cells of the triangulations. There's no constraint now on the two simplices because the theory is not topological. But there's some action, there's some weight for these configurations. And there's a good way to discretize this part of the action. But there's no good way to discretize this part of the action. It's a very strange term called from the lattice, from your lattice field theory, because this term is actually on a closed manifold with no boundary. It's actually a locally constant term in the space of connection. Doesn't change your connection a little bit. Shouldn't change. It's a topological term. However, on the lattice, there's nothing like that. There's no way to separate the configuration space of a gauge on the lattice into disconnected sectors. That's a big problem for lattice simulation of these kind of theories. People typically set this parameter to zero and then simulate. However, it's not quite true that you cannot put sort of this theory on the lattice with non-zero theta. You can, but there's a nice way to simulate theory. There's a nice way to discretize this theory for some special values of theta. And what are these values? Well, it turns out that these are precisely the values which are appear here. That is, say for gauge groups, say Sn mod Zn, like here. There are 2n discrete values of theta for which there is a sensible lattice formulation. Precisely for those values, you get conjecture is that for those particular values of theta for which you do have a sensible lattice simulation, at low energy, the theory does become equivalent to one of these topological field theories which I described here. So, incidentally, this kind of, in the paper we explain a concrete way how to do detection on the lattice, how to simulate a the discrete values of theta. It actually gives something interesting even for the case of abelian gauge group, not like U1. So there's a nice way to, for U1, one can use this kind of approach to find a nice lattice version of U1 with an arbitrary rational value of theta. So, maybe even irrational if you're, but then of course, then the formulation involves some integration rather than sums, and then it's not really good for any practical method of simulation. For an irrational value of theta, there's some lattice formulation which involves both gauge fields living on one cells and these two cell variables, like I drew. That is, if you want to simulate, theta, which is a rational number like this, you need to work with variables where variables on one cell live in U1 as before, but you also need variables which live in two cells, and they're going to live in Z mod N. And using these two sort of variables, one can latticize this action with theta of this form. So it might actually be useful for in practice for lattice simulation living Young Angles theories. Okay. Well, so far what I was describing was kind of two extreme cases. What I really would like to discuss is that...
Is that value in the Lie algebra of the group you just erased? Where does it take its value?
Who does?
Capital F. It's Lie algebra value?
This one? Yes.
In which Lie algebra? The Lie algebra of the
big... In the right... You win.
Yeah.
Lie algebra is the same, right? So,
doesn't matter. So... That's some, the theta term is some characteristic class.
So in continuum?
In the continuum, the thing on the right that has the wedge.
Yeah, it's just the C2.
That's C2.
Yeah. And the trouble is you cannot put C2 in the lattice. However, if I have non-supercontinuum group, C2 mod something can be related to some other classes like W2. And that's what we're using here.
Wouldn't it lead to divergence to try to sum over C2 anyway, since it could take on infinite number of values?
Right, that's another problem. When you restrict yourself to the discrete values, you don't need to sum over infinite set. Mm-hmm. Yeah. As I said, for U1, for example, you can have a lattice formulation of sorts with a good discretization of even of irrational theta, but then of course you have summation over infinite number, infinite sets, it's not really practical. However, for an irrational value of theta, you can have a lattice formulation where you just use basically n-fold cover of the original gauge group and two cell variables living in nth roots of unity, and then you're fine in principle. There's only a finite cell complex, you're going to have a finite summation to do.
One question.
Yes?
When you're doing the theta, is your phase function from, you have different phases as you're doing theta here? So what is the, then you're classifying phases, what is it?
Yeah, so in principle, they should, there could be some whole flow, right? So it should be some, maybe first order phase transition or something like that. So
is it mean that when theta is here and then...
Well, see, on the lattice, there's no easy way to change theta. That's the problem. Once I have a completely rigorous formulation on the lattice, mm-hmm. there's really no way to simulate continuous changes of theta. So you're stuck with some particular theta, and therefore... I actually think there's some no-go theorem. There is any attempt to... Even people say that there is a way to simulate with generic theta. I don't think it's actually what they're doing is actually correct way of doing it. That is, I think you have the following options. Either simulated at fixed values of theta, namely these ones, which are allowed by sort of possible low energy behavior. Or if you try to simulate continuous values of theta, you'll actually end up with a field rather than a number. So an axion. And there should be some no-go theorem to that effect. That is.
But if I don't do theta continuously, how many different phases do you have for
it? Well, that's what the label.
That's a number.
That's classification, yes. If I could in principle, try to go from one to the other, I'll have to encounter some gapless phases, right? Mm-hmm. Just that I don't know how to actually implement it.
But we don't know, is there some figure out the critical point? Or?
No, I don't really know, yeah. Judging by the continuum theories, which are quite rigorous, should be some, maybe first, in systematic cases, you can see there are some second order phase transitions. So now I want to explain the general case, namely, meaning suppose I have some microscopic gauge group and then both Higgs and confinement operate at the same time. what is the most general field theory I can, which can appear as a topological field theory at low energies? So, again, I cannot prove this, but these are separate lines of argument which lead to the same answer. And one line of argument is start from some simple case which you understand and then describe mathematical structure and see what it looks like, try to generalize. Another one, try to write a consistent lattice model. And the most general one, which has the following properties. Well, we're going to have some one-cell variables living in some group, some two-cell variables living in some abelian group, and some constraint relating them all. Now, both kinds of reasonings lead to the same answer. I think it's a unique answer. Namely, what should replace a finite group in Diagram-Witten theory or abelian group in this confining theory is something called the crossed module. So there are different ways to think about it. Several ways. None of the ways are particularly pretty. I don't know which one you prefer. So here's way number one. That's sort of the most categorical. Put this thing. So instead of G, start with a finite two group. So what's a two group? Well, a group is a category with one object and all arrows invertible. That's probably not everybody's favorite definition of a group, but it works. So a two group, it's a two category with one object and all arrows invertible and all two arrows invertible. So a two category has objects, arrows, and arrows between arrows. So I want every arrow to have an inverse, and every arrow between arrows also have an inverse.
So what monism should be strictly invertible or
up to isomorphism. Yeah, so they're weakly invertible. So every composition of all arrow, for every arrow should be another arrow, so that composition is isomorphic to a trivial.
Out of
two monism
or?
Yeah, two. So it's a weak two-group. That's one way of doing it. Another way of doing it, more concrete, is like this. Actually, where the word cross-module came from, it's from the following structure. Keep forgetting these axioms. So we're going to have, instead of G, we're going to have a quadruple. G, H, T, alpha. And G is going to be a group. And H is going to be a group. A pair of groups. And both in principle non-abelian. And then we're going to have a homomorphism from H to G. And then alpha is an action of G on H. It's a homomorphism from G to automorphisms of H. So G acts on H by automorphisms. So it should be there's some compatibility condition which I can never, you know, memorize. Two conditions. G is any element of capital G and little h is any element of capital H. Okay. These two conditions. one can show that, you know, this data essentially defines some sort of two group. Okay, that's better because it's more concrete, but it's still pretty ugly. It's also not minimal in the sense that, unlike a group, you know, if you tell a group, here's my group, if you look at another group, which is isomorphic to it, or this is the same group, it must have the same number of elements as the very least. So a group is a set. You know, you cannot, equivalent group is the same group, right? There's a certain number of elements. It's not true for two categories or two groups. There is two different two groups can be equivalent without actually having the same G and H. Okay? And that's because physically, G is going to basically the Higgs part of the group, which further is confined, right? So actually don't physically don't see G. You see only the unconfined part of G. So it shouldn't be physical. And indeed, equivalence of two groups can change G and H. So what is actual minimal data which determine everything? So that's my favorite definition, even though it's the most, the least intuitive in a sense. But it depends only on the relevant, physically relevant data. Well, you see, okay, so if you have this homomorphism, right, from H to G. So it has kernel and has co-kernel. The kernel is going to be denoted by 2, and the co-kernel, that is quotient of G by the image of T, is going to be denoted by 1. Now, you can first of all, you can check that from these axioms that, first of all, pi 2 is always abelian, just from the definition of all these two properties. You can check also that, indeed, the, you know, the image of H under T is a normal subgroup of G, so the quotient is actually a group. And further, you can check that the image of T in G acts trivially on pi 2, therefore pi 1 can be thought of as acting on pi 2. So I'm going to reinterpret alpha as an action of pi 1 on pi 2, because anyway, anything in the image of T acts trivial on pi 2. So I can replace my horrible data by something equally horrible, but actually more physical. Pi 1, pi 2, alpha. Alpha is an action of pi 1 on pi 2. And then there's another piece of data which is less obvious. I think I'm not going to explain where it comes from. Inside this data, it's an element in H3 of B pi 1 with coefficients in pi 2. So it's a degree 3 cohomology class of this classifying space with values in pi 2.
So it's a two-stage cosmic dot shower.
Yes, it's a homotopy 2 type. Yes. So this data is what needed to define a lattice model. And physically, what is the meaning? That's going to be the unbroken sort of electric gate group. So this is going to be sort of magnetic gate group, the level of magnetic charges. So okay, so that's sort of it's a representation of this label electric charges can absorb at long distances. This labels magnetic charges. Now, why is there a non-trivial action of this on that? Well, we think about the example. Suppose you have, this is like, suppose your electric gate group contains charge conjugation, then it flips the sign of magnetic charge. So you can see from the example that indeed the electric gate transformations can act non-trivial magnetic charges. So that's a simple example. And what is this? Well, I cannot explain any simple terms, but I can explain the level of the lattice model that leads to. Okay. So, anyway, so the claim that this data define the most possible topological field theories which can arise as a limit of gauge theory, because it contains both essential pieces of physics, namely confinement and Higgs. And when you construct lattice model for it, it involves two kinds of variables. One cell variables living in pi 1, and two cell variables living in pi 2. And then there are two kinds of constraints. First of all, for every two cell, for every triangle, there is a constraint that product of the pi 1 variables around the boundary is 1. So there are two constraints. So first of all, the product is 1. And second, there's a constraint on H variables, which is trickier. So Okay, what's the naive version? Well, the most naive version would be to take, again, sum over these H variables. And say it's zero. But that's sort of only correct, or is corresponds to the case when alpha is trivial, no action of pi 1 and pi 2, and also beta is trivial. So how do you include alpha? Well, think about it. All these H's live on the faces of the tetrahedron. When I sum them up, I need to, first of all, bring them to the same point, right? And even non-trivial, that's all non-trivial under the gauge group, we need to do it carefully. Say, if this is my reference point, say zero. I can imagine that all the faces adjacent to this vertex are already sort of refer to this point. But the fourth face here, well, the best I can do is refer to this point. Still has to be parallel transported here. So I have to give this H0. So really it's more like this. Alpha G 1 0 of H0 minus H1 plus H2 minus H3 equals 0. So what this means is that H is a cochain with values in pi 2, but it's not a cocycle with respect to the naive sort of check co-boundary. It's a local cochain. Like you have a local cochain associated to the local system coming from this pi 1 local system. See, pi 1 acts on pi 2, so once I have a local system for pi 1, I can associate the local system for pi 2, and then that's the simplicial version of the closedness in that local cochain complex. Okay, that takes care of alpha. And then there is beta, and that's easy. I just put here beta of, you know, beta is a function of three group elements in this. It's G1, G2, G3. G1, G2, G3. So this is sort of twisted. So the co-boundary is not zero, it's equal to beta. Because that's the lattice model, and one can show that this model is topologically invariant. There's invariant under subdivisions, and gauge invariant under all possible gauge transformations. And that is the configuration space for a model, analogous to the diagram. It's not that complicated in the end. So two cell variables and one cell variable with some, well, not too bad a constraint. Yes?
There's something distressing about your notation, because just on the Digraph-Witten side, there's already a distinction between electric and magnetic particles in mixtures, which are called dions. So usually electric particles are referred to as particles that result from violation of flatness, and magnetic from violation of gauge invariance.
Right. So,
so that would all be on your pi 1 side.
Well, I guess my terminology is slightly different. For example, this theory, there'll be two kinds of loop guys. One of them is representations of labeled representation of pi 1,
yeah.
And another one by violations of this flatness condition for the tetrahedra.
I see. So you're kind of lumping what in the previous notation were called electric and magnetic particles and dions. You're lumping them all into...
More like a doubling, if you wish, because you still have... Okay, in four dimensions, if you look at Digraph-Witten theory,
yeah.
There are sort of loops, Wilson loops,
yeah.
Which live on one-dimensional submanifolds. Mm-hmm. And then there are surfaces, which live on dimension two surfaces. This is the places where the flatness constraint is violated, right?
Yes.
So the loop and surfaces. So it's not like there are electric loops or magnetic loops. They're only electric loops.
Oh, I see. You're saying that in Digraph-Witten, the decomposition of particles into those three types is a feature of two dimensions.
2+1, I would say. Yeah, so like if in three dimensions, Digraph-Witten gives you indeed electric loops, magnetic loops.
Yeah.
In four dimensions,
okay.
So this is gives you electric and magnetic in four dimensions.
Mm.
You can also do it, of course, in three dimensions. And then, of course, you will have electric loops and magnetic points at hoofed footer points, something like that.
Okay.
So it's a bit different, yeah, but yeah. Okay, so this is the most general model I can actually write down, because it basically describes two homotopy type. So you basically map to. So this is the most general model I can write with one cell and two cell variables. Okay. Now, classifying actions is a bit harder because, this datum does correspond to some sort of topological space analogous to this b squared of pi 2 or b pi 1. There is a classifying space. But let me call the whole thing, I don't know, curve, like this. There's a classifying space attached to it. It's a tricky one. It has more than one non-vanishing homotopy group. So it's actually fibration over b pi 1 with fiber b squared pi 2. So there's two non-trivial homotopy groups, pi 1 because of this and pi 2 because of this. But there's more information about this. Well, the way this fibration is arranged is hidden as alpha and beta. So it's a bit harder to compute the cohomology of this, but that's what you need to do if you want to compute, classify all possible actions for this theorem. And in our third paper, we actually do that. And the answer is rather, well, let me perhaps take this. So for low dimensions, one can do it. So I don't know if you just take for dimension 4 as the most complicated case we dealt with. So in dimension 2, by the way, you don't get anything new. So this theory is actually equivalent to Diagram-Whitten theory. In dimension 3, they do get something new. But one can show that duality can always, well, okay. So in three dimensions, one can dualize this H variables living in two simplices to variables living in on zero simplices, on vertices. So you get sort of a gauged sigma model. You have a variables living in the Pantragin dual, in the characters of pi 2 living on zero cells, as well as this variables g living on one cells. It's kind of like Diagram-Whitten coupled to some matter, but it's a non-trivial action. So in four dimensions, let me just see what the answer is for the action. So action, well, there's some special sequence which computes this cohomology. So basically the result is that this cohomology group in degree 4 has three pieces, which corresponds to the composition of the action is a sum of three pieces. So schematically, it's something like this. So I think about this cocycle G, one cocycle, as a map to the classifying space of pi 1. So G is a map from M to pi, B pi 1. So omega is some degree 4 class is a Diagram-Whitten theory, which you can pull back and integrate over M. That's the third term. Now lambda lives here. So what is this? So see, over b pi 1 there's a local system with the principal bundle with fiber pi 1. So I can associate to, since pi 1 acts on pi 2, also acts on the dual of pi 2. So I can look at the cohomology local system with, you know, fiber pi 2 hat over b pi 1. And I look at the cohomology of that system. That's where lambda lives. So when I pull it back using this g, you're going to get a 2 form. I take cup product with a 2 form with values in pi 2, basically. Contract with pi 2 hat, get the 4 form, and then I integrate. And then q is this quadratic function. It's basically quadratic function pi 2, but with some extra conditions. it must be pi 1 invariant and also satisfy some kind of compatibility condition with that class B. But anyway, if I apply quadratic function to a 2 form, I'm going to get a 4 form, which I then integrate. So this is the most general action for this theory. Okay, so what do we learn from this? Well, first of all, one would like to understand whether this theory is really new. And I think in general, they are new, that it's going to dualize to a theory of known type like Dagger-Whitten theory. So even in three dimensions, where the situation is a bit simpler, we can show that you can also do duality, but it doesn't help. It doesn't reduce the theory to Dagger-Whitten type theory, or rather some Dagger-Whitten theory coupled to some topological sigma model. Another way is another question one can ask, okay, so how can I actually construct such theories with non-trivial, well, some phases which of gauge theory which actually float one of these topological field theories? So that's, I'm not sure. So as I discussed the case when pi 1 is trivial and pi 2 is non-trivial, but I'm not sure in general how to construct a lattice model, physical lattice model, which actually realizes one of those topological field theories for general pi 1 and pi 2. So a far just classification of possibilities. And then the last thing I'd like to sort of propose is that, well, I'm not saying this is the most general topological field theory in four dimensions. There are probably many more. It just sort of to indicate that there are lots of possibilities in four dimensions. For many years, the Dagger-Whitten theory was the only one sort of available, and it's just another class of theories. But I'd like to suggest that since these theories are kind of similar to Dagger-Whitten theories, they may have a similar application in condensed matter physics. Namely, recently there was a lot of interest in classifying so-called symmetry-protected phases with a fixed symmetry group. And the proposal is classified by degree D cohomology of that group. Now here we have a more general object, namely two group. And I would like to propose that there are more general symmetry-protected phases labeled by for a fixed two group by cohomology classes here. And what this means physically is that when you consider global symmetry and phases of some particular global symmetry, you usually assume that your symmetries act on variables living at the sides of your lattice. And they don't mix different sides. Sort of ultra-local action. That's one possibility, but another possibility is to have transformations living, acting, say, on one-cell variables. You can have transformation living both here and there. And then there can be some interaction between them. So the claim is that the only natural, the only consistent way somehow to arrange this is to say that these two types of symmetry transformations are labeled by elements of a group and the abelian group, and with some extra data. So the most general symmetry, which you have a sort of having a two symmetry, is like having symmetry which leaves both on zero cells and one cells. And just like gauging a symmetry gives you a gauge field, gauging a two symmetry gives you a more interesting gauge field where, you know, zero cell gauge symmetry gets promoted, zero cell global symmetry gets promoted to one cell variables, and one cell symmetry transformation gets promoted to two cell gauge fields. So, for this reason, I think that this cohomology labels different symmetry topological phases where the symmetry is allowed to act both on one cell and two cell variables. So, and in the paper, there's some simple examples of the case where simple cases of to explain what in what situation you can actually have a one-cell symmetry that is, say, just pi 2, no pi 1. As I said, I don't know any physical examples where both pi 1 and pi 2 are non-trivial, but I have no examples where pi 2 is non-trivial. And that's an example where pi 2 appears as a global symmetry acting on one cell variables only, which can be gauged and promoted to a two form then. So, and I think, in fact, examples of such phases in 3 plus 1 dimensions protected simply by pi 2, by sort of one cell symmetry, have appeared already in the condensed matter literature. So I'd like to make the connection more precise, but I think they did appear as sort of counterexample to the proposal that everything is classified by the usual group cohomology. So I think I'll stop here.
Yeah. Do you know anything about if you put the thing on a
place with boundaries?
Yeah, it's tricky. So in case when pipe 2 is non-trivial, we looked at one special case, because pipe 2 is a cyclic group, so Z mod n. So it looks like on the boundary, in this case, you must have a sort of topological order. If you don't want to break this 2 symmetry, you have to have a non-trivial degrees of freedom on the boundary, on the 3-dimensional boundary of 4-dimensional space time. And on the boundary, you can, for example, put a Chern-Simons theory at some level, at the right level. And at least that's true when pi 2 is a cyclic group. We didn't check general finite abelian group, but probably the same thing. There is this class. Okay. When this class here vanishes, of course, there's no problem. But if class is non-trivial, that means that on the boundary, you've got to have some non-trivial amount of degrees of freedom with some sort of anomaly for this 2 symmetry, which cancels the anomaly in the bulk. It's kind of similar to what happens with Dagger-Pitten theory in 1 plus 1 dimensions. When you have non-trivial class in H2 of the group, it means that on the boundary, you've got to have a projective representation of the group, sort of cancels the anomaly. So similarly here.
Are you talking about a kind of a two-category version of like what Wendt for Tom Hall states in 1990?
What did he do?
To try to when you in the presence of a boundary.
Oh yeah, well, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of similar because you have. Yeah, because here you have two form gauge fields.
Yeah.
And then, so in this case, yeah, we have H4 of b squared of pi 2.
Yeah.
You have gauge symmetry parameters by one forms.
Yeah.
And that's the thing which is anomalous when you have boundary. And you can cancel that by adding Chern-Simons field on the boundary. And Chern-Simons theory has sort of, naively Chern-Simons theory has symmetry under shifting by closed one forms, but in fact has anomaly too.
Yeah.
And that cancels the bulk anomaly. Yes.
On a four torus. So that is so you are saying so these two distinct cases you are describing, they have the same thing. Do they have topological legitimacy or do they have?
Well, four torus is not very interesting. Yeah. Okay, so I don't know in general. Okay, so I didn't compute the answer in general, even for pi 1 trivial. If you have pi 2 and some quadratic function pi 2, I'm not sure what the degeneracy is. When the quadratic function is non degenerate, then of course the four torus case isn't trivial, essentially. That is, on a general four manifold, in that case, you at most get a phase proportional to the signature, and since on general, from a three-manifold process one, the signature will be trivial, so you won't have nothing. However, if your quadratic form is degenerate, then I haven't done the computation. So I'm not quite sure what we're going to get. I think basically what we're going to get is the same degeneracy as for Dagger-Pitten theory, whose group is the kernel of this quadratic function. What is bilinear? Well, if a quadratic function can define bilinear form. Well, okay, so you just look at things where it vanishes. You find some subgroup in pi 2, and I think the answer is going to be the same as in Dagger-Pitten theory, or in just topological gauge theory, whose gauge group is this finite group, the kernel of quadratic function. Yes?
Can you generalize the three groups?
Formally, yes, but I suspect it won't give you anything new. Because I think using sort of Poincaré duality can always replace things living on, you know, three cells, same four dimensions. I think in dimension D you can also need to go only half the dimension. Once you go higher, probably can really dualize everything to things of lower dimensions.
In answering the last question, it sounded like your theory has the same issue that, say, the Crane-Yetter theory had, that it only gives non-trivial answers when the signature is non-zero. Is that what you were saying about the four torus?
Well, that depends on this quadratic function. Quadratic function doesn't have to be non-degenerate.
But if the quadratic function is non-degenerate?
Yes, then if you have only pi 2 and quadratic function is non-degenerate, then you get just one.
functions of the the partition function depends only on the signature in that case?
So yes, yeah. It actually is the same theory, it's, okay. I think. Yeah.
So, even in the past, tried to generalize topological order with higher form gauge theories in different dimensions. So, for example, Shorong-Wen has what was found, at least whatever they attempted, was that if you are in four space time dimensions, if you write on a two form gauge theory, it's essentially same as one form because of singularity. And they said you have to go at least five space time dimensions to get anything non trivial with higher form gauge theory.
Let me put it this way. So, but the thing which makes things more complicated, perhaps, is that dualization is only possible really when your action is linear in the variable you're trying to dualize. And this Q term here sort of prevents you from doing that in general. Indeed, when this term is trivial, you can dualize this B to a one-form variable, and then you're going to end up with essentially Dyagraph-Witten theory with some complicated class which is expressed through this, depends also on this beta class here and everything. But in general, you also have this quadratic function of B, and then you have a problem dualizing. So I think that's why in general it's different. Yep. In three dimensions, you don't have that, by the way. In three dimensions, you only have linear terms in B. In three dimensions, you can't dualize always to a Dyagraph-Witten theory.
Thanks, speaker again.
Well, I don't know, you have to get to it.